Knowledge which is acquired through compulsion obtains no hold on the mind. Plato.
Hello everyone and welcome to the EdTech Podcast. My name is Songnan. I'm here with Malika.
Hello.
And Edil.
Hello.
And we're super excited to probe into the topic of, is self-directed learning a fallacy? But before we get into it, we're sixth form students from 621 and we have been working on this project with Sophie for the past 12 weeks as part of our work experience, and we hope you find it as insightful as it was for us to look into. So, self-directed learning. Some people may argue that it's a fallacy, and some may not. Essentially, as stated by Knowles in 1975, self-directed learning is a process in which individuals take initiative, with or without the help of others, diagnosing their learning needs, formulating learning goals, identifying human and material sources for learning, choosing and implementing appropriate learning strategies, and evaluating learning outcomes. Inevitably, there's a lot of discussion regarding self-directed learning and the pros and cons of it, since it's very dependent on the individual. In this episode, we explore self-directed learning from the perspective of a neuroscientist, a learner, and an educational leader. So here we go.
In Charles Dickens's Hard Times, the character Gradgrind says, "Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life." But increasingly, educators are questioning whether today's students will be served by this model. The knowledge versus skills debate is loud and clear, with one side of the argument calling for more focus on creativity, communication, and collaboration. Some schools are taking a more self-directed approach, but are young people equipped for self-directed learning? The neuroscientist Dick Swab writes in his book titled We Are Our Brains.
The prefrontal cortex plays a central role in regulating our brain's behaviour and is responsible for, among other things, for control of our impulses, complex actions, planning and organisations. It doesn't fully mature until a person is in his or her 20s.
And according to the neuropsychologist Yella Jones, this explains why a recent restructuring of the Dutch secondary school system that focused on independent study is flawed. So what is correct balance between teacher and student? Is a traditional approach to learning too passive, or is self-directed learning a fallacy?
This is our episode of the EdTech Podcast. To explore the notion of self-directed learning and our capacity as learners, we spoke to Dr. Irawaz de Montville, Director of Educational Neuroscience at Birkbeck University, London, to find out how we learn when we are in our adolescent years. Here is what she said.
My name is Irawaz de Montville. I'm a researcher and lecturer at Birkbeck in cognitive neuroscience. And my research is about the teenage brain and the differences in the brain and behaviour and cognition between adolescents and adults.
So, what is your opinion on self-directed learning? From your research, what do you know about the adolescent brain and how does the brain function during this time frame?
There's been quite a lot of research on it in the last couple of decades, and basically showing that the brain during adolescence continues to change quite a lot. So we used to think that after age 8 or 9, the size of the brain was the same as the size of an adult brain, and not much after that. It was all about learning. But actually, thanks to research of using a machine called magnetic resonance imaging scanner, we've been able to look at the structure, the anatomy of the teenage brain, as well as how it's functioning. And what we see is that actually the anatomy is changing quite a lot. So something called the gray matter, which is where the neurons are, is kind of shrinking during adolescence. And white matter, which is the connections between different parts of the brain, is increasing, which means that regions that are far away can exchange information quicker. And so the whole brain, the whole networks can work more efficiently over the course of adolescence. And what's been found as well is that all the brain doesn't like go through this process at the same time. So some brain regions that involve sensation, controlling your movements, so motor control, do this process of development earlier, like more during childhood, while things like planning and acting on your own thoughts and thoughts of other people, interacting with other people, this is still kind of continuing to change during adolescence. So that's kind of the key results. And apart from that, another kind of aspect of the research has been found is that there's two contexts that kind of matter during adolescence, what we call the hot context and the cold context. And I think in terms of self-directed learning, the cold context is actually kind of more relevant because you don't have kind of very strong emotion or like your peers involved when you're kind of doing this kind of more, I view the self-directed learning as a bit more personal, like kind of unique, you're doing this for your own good, individual. So in this cold context, actually we find that adolescents, you know, during mid-adolescence can become able to reach similar level to adults in terms of decision making. But the hot context is where there are kind of more differences between adolescents and adults. So adolescents are more sensitive to rewards, to kind of the short-term kind of rewards and consequences of their actions, the social context, their kind of self-esteem and kind of how, what they think other people might be thinking of them. All this are kind of affect the decisions that adolescents might be taking. So there's a greater influence of peers, the greater sensation seeking. And so it's in these contexts that there are differences. So that's the whole problem, is that in terms of education, being academically, you know, good has not always been regarded as something, you know, valued during adolescence, and that can be a bit of a clash because you've got this kind of social peer influence, and in general the cool kids don't think that, you know, getting good grades is cool or is good, then that might kind of have a negative influence on other teenagers' kind of interest in academic performance. So that might impact their kind of self-directed learning and how motivated they are to learn.
So I found that some of your research is on self-regulation. Can you possibly tell us a bit about that?
So self-regulation, how you kind of regulate your emotions and your thoughts and your kind of behavior to achieve your goals. And it's one thing that is thought, you know, continue to mature during adolescence, in part because I was saying this sensitivity to reward and a social context that kind of might affect your kind of decision making. And another component is it's been found that adolescents seem to experience emotion, at least in their brain responses, more strongly than children and adults. So a region of their brain called the amygdala, which reacts when you see like a fearful face or an angry face or something, kind of a snake, seems to react more to kind of show greater activity in adolescents than children and adults. So it could be that they're actually experiencing this more strongly, which means that regulating it down, kind of saying, no, it's fine, and nothing to worry about, or this friend didn't really mean to offend me, or like kind of trying to kind of relativize, like make it less, kind of less of a negative thing, can be more difficult during adolescence. So increased distraction during adolescence, there's kind of different levels. So there's a level of, can your prefrontal cortex, your attention system, be capable of keeping you on task? And that is also kind of partly still continuing to mature, but most of it would probably be more like earlier childhood and early adolescence. But there's a component of, you know, what are of interest to you and to your brain during that age. And again, the social kind of social things, your peers, is very important. So I think that would be a challenge for this kind of self-directed learning, or even outside a self-directed learning context, just doing your homework. And with the ease now of technologies to be having kind of text messages that can be always coming and calls, etc., or Facebook, and kind of how do you actually manage to not be distracted all the time? And some people think that, you know, we might become quite good at multitasking, actually, we're humans are very bad at multitasking, and we don't actually multitask. We switch between tasks. So we do something and then switch to something else and switch back. And every time we switch, there's a cost. So it takes us a while to get back into whatever we're doing. So I think this is a challenge, but it's not specific to adolescents. It's only in the sense that adolescents care a lot about their peers and the social kind of networks. So in that sense, there's a bit of a specificity, but adults in our society also find kind of difficult to not be distracted by emails at work or text messages and things. So
just regarding the subject of rewards, what if some adolescents are unresponsive to rewards?
I don't think that our adolescents that are, like, most people are sensitive to reward because this is how our brain functions and kind of learns. Like, we kind of go towards things that are kind of have a positive context. But the reward might not be, you know, monetary or stars. It can be this kind of maybe sense of achieving something yourself, which is kind of more relevant to the self-directed learning. So reward is actually a very broad thing. Addiction used to be kind of really about drug addiction, and now they went into kind of gambling, and then went into kind of video game addiction. So you can have addictions to actually things that are kind of actually quite beyond just the pleasure of food or drugs. And I think it's the same in this kind of general sensitivity to reward. So I mean, I need to kind of qualify what I'm saying is that, you know, it's not the case that there's this massive difference between adolescents. This is all kind of quite subtle. And between adolescents, there's a huge spectrum. So some adolescents might be more sensitive to peers, more risk-taking. Others might not be, that during kind of they might go through the course of adolescence without having this kind of a massive upheaval. So there's a huge spectrum, and other adolescents might go during adolescence have the start of depression or anxiety, because that's the time where it can start. And in terms of self-directed learning, that, you know, anxiety could potentially, you know, play a role and be kind of stressed a lot about your achievement or your kind of school performance. Depression might a bit the reverse, or you might actually, you know, lose interest and drive in kind of achieving.
I want to ask, what would you say are ways of improving self-regulation?
So it feels like first kind of some awareness of the changes, and then it's kind of, you know, reflection on what strategy you could adopt. Research at the moment about, and I've done some on mindfulness meditation. I don't know whether you've kind of heard about this. And so it's kind of becoming more widespread in schools. We don't know yet exactly what might be the positive impact, whether they're kind of widespread impact or not. But it may, in adulthood, it helps against kind of depression starting again, like and anxiety. So it might, there's some thought that it might be helpful during adolescence to kind of help you cope with these strong emotions and kind of feeling more in the moment, and then trying to kind of achieve your goals without being kind of carried away by some kind of thoughts on rumination. It could be that actually instead of spending time meditating, adolescents might be better off doing sport, because this is also good for your brain and it's also good for your body, and it might actually, you know, you release some reward, kind of endorphins. So yeah, I think there's, it's kind of still out there what is the best thing that one could be done, that could be done, but it probably is a case, it will depend on adolescents. So one person, sport might be more successful, and another person, mindfulness might be a, you know, better thing for them.
So each learner is individual, but it might be fair to conclude that an average adolescent might find some aspects of self-directed learning a challenge, given their demands for sleep, peer recognition and other factors, and the ability to know how to learn is unfairly weighted towards those who have already successfully navigated traditional educational systems, such as university. This demographic is more likely to then go on to learn through additional means, including online courses through their own personal learner network opportunities. What if these learner opportunities don't work for you? Indeed, here is a past guest of the EdTech podcast, Tawul Shah, highlighting just this point.
Learning online is actually really difficult, even for the most motivated people. So starting with the course, learning how to learn, and then you can go on to these other courses so that your chances of failure are reduced. It's still high.
One school that is not underestimating the power of young learners to switch on their own brains and engage in their development is our award-winning School 21 in Newham, London. We convinced our head teacher and co-founder of the school, Peter Hyman, to talk to us about his philosophy of learning and his own experiences of being a motivated learner. Okay, so firstly, can you tell us about yourself and what you do?
My name is Peter Hyman, and I am the executive head teacher and one of the founders of School 21.
What is your opinion on self-directed learning, and to what extent do you believe this is possible?
There are many good examples of self-directed learning. So I've got a son, for example, who's 12 years old, and he goes onto YouTube and he watches lots of clips on YouTube of how to do magic tricks or how to make slime or how to do animation, and then he teaches himself how to do it. So that's a good example of a case where you haven't got a teacher in front of you, but you've got a teacher remotely, and then you're directing it. He's doing that in his own time, at his own pace, when he chooses to do it. He's decided what to look up. He's decided what his passion is, and he can direct himself. So that's one example. But there's other examples, and I still believe very passionately that the great thing about schools is that you've got that interaction between the teacher, the student, and the texts. And the text, you can say, is literally, could be a text, a piece of literature, it could be an artifact, or it could be a play. In different areas, there's different texts. But it's that interplay of those three things that can make something magical happen. And I think that's the thing that you lose if you're just directing your own learning.
Continuing from, like you said before, about technology and your son uses YouTube, how feasible do you think it is to learn on an academic scale using self-directed learning?
I think self-directed learning can work for a certain type of student, but the conditions have to be right. You've got to have someone very well motivated. You've got to have someone probably with a base knowledge in that subject who can take it to the next level. You've got to have a forum of some kind where you could ask questions or unlock dilemmas or things that you don't understand. So it is possible, but whether it's the best way of learning and whether if you take out that direct contact with the teacher, you get the best way of learning is open to question. And the evidence is not yet there that that is better than having a teacher in the room with you. But I can see, for example, in developing countries where there may be a shortage of teachers, where it may be hard for you to get to class in some way, if there was some way through technology to give people access to some of the best learning online, that might be a very good solution.
What do you think the main advantages with self-directed learning is, and do you think that there are any drawbacks with it?
The great benefits of self-directed learning are clearly that the learner is in control. So they're not being told, like the timetable of a school, you're now going to English for 50 minutes and maths for 50 minutes and you're on the conveyor belt. They're saying, right, I'm directing my own learning. I want to learn this. So there's motivation. I've decided I'm going to learn this course and I'm motivated to find out how to get onto the course, and then I'm going to carry out the course, and I can do it at my own pace, and I can, in an ideal world, I can decide I'm going to do it every evening at this time, and it, that suits me, let's say, if I'm out at work during the day. So there's a flexibility to it, and there's an individual being in charge of it, which is really important. So that's the big upside. The downside, as I say, is that it's a very impersonal way of learning very often. And I believe learning is partly a community activity. We learn at best by bouncing ideas off the person that we're talking to in a classroom or in whatever setting it is, around a meeting table. You're sharing ideas, you're sharing thoughts. Learning is social. I believe you get deeper understanding by doing it in a social way. Now, in a sophisticated way of doing online learning, you can combine both, because you can have forums and webinars where you can be more interactive. So it's not impossible at all for technology to be able to do the individual bit as well as the social bit.
What impact do you think self-directed learning would have on teachers and the teaching community?
It depends how you do it, because you could say there's a equal need for teachers. They're just going to be doing it remotely. They're going to be producing videos. They're going to be hosting online webinars, so they still have that interaction with students, but it's one removed. So you can still say it's a similar role, but now using technology. Or you can say it's a very different role, because it's not about that teacher's interaction live in one place, in one school, with the 20 or 30 or however many young people in front of them. So it can go either way.
Have you ever tried self-directed learning?
I have tried a few examples. I've tried to get good at jazz piano. So I copied my son and I went on and looked at YouTube clips and I did tutorials online about how to get good at the jazz piano. For me personally, I think I would have been better with a teacher because I wasn't motivated enough when I was frustrated by it. The thing, and it's another, I think, important point now that I'm thinking through, is you've made me think that at the point when you want to give up, the thing about a teacher is they're also spurring you on, aren't they? They're giving you encouragement. So I had no one in the room next to me as I would if I'd got a piano teacher to come and help me. They wouldn't have said, well, actually, persevere now. All I'm doing is copying what someone's doing on a YouTube clip and they're not personally interacting with me. So I think that's a weakness of it.
So guiding your own learning isn't easy, but if you're super organised and in the best possible position to maximise your learning, what might the outcomes look like? One success story we came across was Laurie Pickard, who put together her own free MBA course over 2 years and has since documented her experience in the book Don't Pay for Your MBA and the website No Pay MBA. Here's our chat a few weeks back.
Hi, Sangha.
Hey, Laurie. Would you like to tell us a bit about what you do and who you are?
Sure. So I, several years ago, was in a position where I really wanted to get a business education that was, you know, I was looking into MBA programs because I needed a business education to further my career. But I was in a position where it didn't really make sense for me to go back to school and spend the kind of money that you spend in a graduate business program, a traditional one. And this happened to coincide with the time when massive open online courses were just becoming popular. So I decided that I would put together my own version of an MBA using the courses that I found and kind of matching those with the curriculum of top business programs. And so that's what I did, and I blogged about it, and that ultimately led to me writing a book, and that's kind of the journey that I've been on. We all know that there is just so much material available on the internet if you know how to find it and if you know how to use it. And so my idea was to try to take all that information that's out there and put it together in such a way that I could get an education that was like an MBA.
So from your experience, how have you gone about implementing and making the most out of self-directed learning for yourself?
That's a good question. So, you know, as I mentioned, there are so many resources that are available, but to actually put them together into an education that can work for you, you've got to find ways to put that education into practice in more kind of real world type situations. So that's kind of how I interpret your question of you know, making the most of that education is to really think about how you can use it in your life. And so what I tried to do throughout my studies was to find opportunities to use whatever it was I was learning. So, for example, if I was studying accounting, I found an opportunity in that example to be the bookkeeper for an organization, you know, an employee association that I was part of. So I kind of found little opportunities like that to put my education into practice.
As self-directed learner yourself, what do you think are the key attributes and characteristics that you'd need?
So in my book, I talk about kind of three characteristics. So one would be an entrepreneurial type of mindset. And by that, I mean a person who is not afraid to think outside the box, to try something new, to do something in which you could fail. So that's one of the characteristics I think is important, is kind of that spirit of entrepreneurship. A second characteristic I would say would be a curiosity or a love of learning. So I think you have to enjoy learning in order to be a successful self-directed learner. Like, you have to actually like what you're doing, since you're going to be the one providing your own motivation to get through whatever learning experience you've set up for yourself. And then the third one, and I guess this applies more to people who are already working or who are maybe perhaps a bit older, but the third adjective that I would use would be professional. But I think that could apply even to a younger student, and maybe the word I would use there would be kind of integrity. That, you know, there are people who will take an online course and who, you know, there was even a scandal about this several years ago, that there were people who would find ways to cheat, you know, that they would go back and take a test over again, or they would sign up for two accounts and to get access to the assessments and be able to kind of cheat the system and get a good grade. Well, if you're a self-directed learner, you have to care about kind of the integrity of your process and really care about the outcome of the learning that you're going to get rather than just thinking about some kind of credential or certificate. So those would be the three characteristics that I would identify.
So of course each individual is different, but what factors do you think could disrupt or have an impact on someone who's trying to conduct self-directed learning?
That's also a really good question, because it is really hard to sustain motivation when you don't have a teacher or professor saying, okay, this is what you need to do, and this is your assignment, and it's due on this particular date, and if you don't turn it in, there are going to be consequences. So you don't have any of that when you're a self-directed learner. So I would say, I mean, there are many things that can derail somebody, you know, losing interest or just not having that motivation to get through. So I guess I would think about this more in terms of what can you do to sustain your interest and to kind of hold yourself accountable. And there are two, I guess, approaches I would take. One would be to choose material that you're intrinsically very interested in and have a strong desire to learn. Because if you're learning something just because you think you're supposed to, it's really hard to stay motivated. So number one would just be kind of your own interest. And then number two would be to try to make yourself accountable in some type of way, you know, to set up some kind of structure or some type of accountability external to yourself that would mimic what a professor or a teacher does, you know, whether that's by having a schedule of assignments or by creating some kind of incentive system for yourself where you reward yourself as you complete whatever your goals are, tell friends and family, and even to have some kind of public commitment to your learning, whether that's through a Facebook group or through social media or by having a blog or in just some sense making your education and your commitment to that education public.
Personally, what did you find was the biggest drawback of going through the process of self-directed learning?
I would say the biggest drawback is the lack of a social component, unless you really find a way to create that for yourself, which can be challenging. So it's lonelier than being in a class with other students. You don't have that same type of built-in community, and that's something that some people manage to create for themselves, and those communities can be very strong. When people go to the trouble to create them and end up finding a good group, but that's certainly not the norm to have that kind of community and self-directed learning.
So I have a question for you. How do you think the experience was different from when you were in school to self-directed learning?
It was very different because I was the one deciding what I was going to study. And I was the one deciding on what timeline I was going to study. And I was the one kind of setting all the benchmarks. So it was very different from, let's say, a high school experience or even an undergraduate college experience. However, I used a lot of the same skills that I learned when I was in high school and college. So I learned, you know, how to do research, for example, how to do an extended research project or an extended learning project that required, you know, pacing myself over several weeks or months. I also learned how to study for an exam, how to take good notes during a lecture, especially if my mind might have a tendency to wander during a lecture. So I used all of those skills. And then I also have a formal graduate degree. And so the education, my self-directed education, resembled in a way that graduate education, because when you get to that level, a lot of what you do becomes self-directed and your professors are there more as guides and as mentors than as taskmasters. So even though I didn't have the guide or mentor in this case, I did have that experience of directing my own learning and kind of knowing how to set a goal like that and carry it out myself.
So how does one continue to improve and take ownership of their learning throughout their life?
It's a complicated question in a way. How does one take ownership of that throughout their lives? Well, I think it really just has to do with making a commitment to continuing to learn and to staying open to newness. Because I think what's fun about learning for somebody who enjoys learning is that it opens your mind. It expands your mind. So I guess I would say that might be the number one thing, would be to cultivate curiosity and openness and to seek out the joy of learning something new that you didn't know anything about previously. And people who do that, I think it ends up not being a chore, but it ends up being a really nice part of life to continually seek out new learning experiences. And we're very fortunate to live during a time when our ability to learn is really unconstrained. I mean, there's just so much out there, from, you know, podcasts to TED Talks to YouTube videos to articles. I mean, so much is available to us that our problem is really more how do we choose what we can learn from, a problem of having too much rather than not enough.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and knowledge on self-directed learning.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That brings us to the end of this week's special episode of the EdTech Podcast. We've touched upon the trials and tribulations of self-directed learning, and we don't think it is a fallacy. But we do think learning motivation is affected by age, circumstance, and access to resources. We would like to thank all of our guests for their contributions to this week's episode. We will be presenting this episode back in our final exhibition at the EdTech Podcast Festival in September. If you'd like to leave feedback, you can tweet us at podcastedtech, and all of this week's show notes will be available at theedtechpodcast.com.
If you enjoyed the episode and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to the EdTech Podcast on iTunes, where you can also leave a review. Thanks for listening in, and we look forward to hearing your own stories of self-guided learning. Bye-bye.